For Radio Autonomía, this is a special recap of our past year, 2012.
We begin 2013 with the reflection on the struggles and victories of 2012. We look back to the conversations and the moments that inspired us to push forward. In the following, we highlight three themes that stand out from the reports. Part 1, power and movement. Part 2, going beyond representative democracy. Part 3, alternative relations of solidarity. And Part 4, reimagining Oakland. Each section features brief excerpts from longer interviews and segments we aired on Radio Autonomía during 2012.
Part 1, power and movement. We began 2012 with a review of major demonstrations throughout the world. It seemed as if 2011 was the year of movement. However, in 2012, we have witnessed the ever-growing spirit of a people always in movement, shifting and transforming. Here we focus on three major international mobilizations, drawing attention to the struggles against austerity, the privatization of education, and corrupt political elections. This first section includes excerpts from our brief report on the Yo Soy 132 movement in Mexico, which we aired in July 2012, our update about student protests worldwide from September 2012, and finally, our report from Spain, which we aired in December 2012.
Today, July 1st, is the date of the presidential election in Mexico, an election that has become, in many ways, a referendum on current president Felipe Calderón's drug war, which has claimed at least 60,000 lives since he was fraudulently elected in 2006. The Yo Soy 132 movement, which some folks are calling the Mexican Spring, interrupted the otherwise vacuous electoral campaign on May 11th, when students at the conservative Catholic University Iberoamericana asked a particularly pointed question to Enrique Peña Nieto, the PRI candidate for president, during a presentation of his political platform. The question was about the intense state violence which took place at Atenco almost exactly 6 years before, in May 2006, when Peña Nieto, then governor of the Estado de Mexico, sent in heavily militarized state and federal police to assault a community associated with the Zapatistas' other campaign. In response to the question, Peña Nieto stood firm, declaring that he had sent in the notoriously violent police in order to reestablish the so-called rule of law. Outraged, hundreds of chanting students chased Peña Nieto and his entourage off campus. The next day, Peña Nieto apologists appeared on the major Mexican television stations, Televisa and TV Azteca, accusing the protesters of being political agents hired to heckle and interrupt the candidate's speech. In response, 131 students from the Ibero who had participated in the protest made a YouTube video showing their university ID cards to prove the accusations false. The video went viral. The following week, students marched on the headquarters of television stations throughout the city to demonstrate their rejection of the media monopoly and the institutionalized bias it reflects. Since then, a number of anti-Peña Nieto marches have brought tens of thousands of protesters into the streets and created the most exciting movement to hit Mexico since Javier Sicilia's campaign against the narco war last year. What started with private university students protesting on their campus has become a broad, but still youth-dominated movement focused on two key issues: the media monopoly and the political system. The power of the youth in the streets is immense, and we can only wait to see what will happen. So we'll close by reading a piece from the movement's second communique, which echoes the Zapatistas' first declaration de la Selva Lacandona, which opens by asserting that we are the product of 500 years of struggle. We are the children of the massacres and repression of students, of dirty war, of rampant impunity, of economic crises, of ideological and material domination, of one way of thinking and one way of living, of senseless violence, of the abandoned countryside, and of undignified working conditions, of deep corruption. We are the children of a new Mexico that yells, ya basta, never again.
For Radio Autonomía, this is DJ Plebe with our September update on education struggles around the world. Today we're going to focus on three sites of struggle: Quebec, Chile, and here in the Bay Area. In Quebec, August 22nd marked another day of mass action, where tens of thousands of protesters marched in Montreal against the continued threat of an 82% tuition hike imposed by the Liberal government in power. The tradition of mass demonstrations on the 22nd of each month began last March, but really exploded in May when as many as 400,000 demonstrators came out on what was not only the 100th day of the student strike, but also the immediate aftermath of the passage of a new authoritarian law, Bill 78, which is now called Law 12, which restricted the right to assemble and protest. It showed that the law had sparked outrage more than fear. Moving on to Chile, if the summer marked something of a lull in the cycle of struggle by students, teachers, and their supporters against the authoritarian state that's been going on for the last 15 months, this past month, it started to pop off again. The new wave of demos began on August 8th, and since then, there have been massive marches with tens and hundreds of thousands of people, the rapid spread of school occupations, and plenty of heavily armed riot police shooting tear gas and water cannons. But there are a couple of new and important developments that we wanted to point out. First, while up until now the universities seem to have taken the lead in the fight, the front line of struggle over the last few weeks has shifted to the high schools. It was high school students this time who sparked the latest wave of occupations. More than 25 schools were occupied across the country, at least 9 of them in Santiago alone. For Radio Autonomía, this has been an education update from DJ Plebe. In the context of a massive recession and harsh austerity measures, the housing crisis in Spain is becoming increasingly acute. In the last 4 years, around 400,000 people have been evicted across the country. Add to that the well-known national unemployment figures of 25% and over 50% for the youth. It's gotten so bad here that foreclosure-related suicides are on the rise. This past week, a man named Manuel Reguera killed himself in the state of Navarra upon receiving an eviction notice. He was the fourth suicide in the last month and a half or so. A fifth person tried to kill himself by jumping out of his balcony, but survived the fall. And yet, the most recent census data shows that between 3 and 6 million housing units are empty across the country. That's between 10 and 20% of the country's residential housing. November 24th was a day of action for the universal right to housing in the southernmost Spanish state of Andalusia. People from cities all across the region, even from Madrid, came together in Sevilla, representing individuals, collectives, organizations, unions, more formalized NGOs, and of course social movements like the 15M or Indignados movement. The goal of the day was to share stories and experiences and to help constitute a unified front of actors fighting in a variety of ways and from diverse political orientations for the right to decent and dignified housing. I asked Amparo and Nico, two compañeros affiliated with the Corral Utopía, to describe the scene.
Bueno, en realidad hoy para mí es un día muy importante, en verdad.
For me, today is a really important day because we're seeing that little by little, we're bringing together more and more people from many different cities, not just one, and everyone can see that we're not alone. And also, to set the scene, I don't think there's a better place where we could be doing this.
Es muy importante, y más el escenario, por ejemplo, que comentabas, el escenario de... Yo creo que no podía haber habido tampoco ninguno mejor, en realidad.
Claro, yo creo que lo mejor del día de hoy es que estamos en la Plaza del Pumarejo, en la Casa del Pumarejo.
The best thing so far today is that we're in the plaza in front of the Casa del Pumarejo, with its intense history of struggle to keep the building from being destroyed. Residents and community members have been fighting with developers and the city government for many years. So, to describe the scene, there are people who pretty much live here because they come to the Centro Vecinal. There are people who've been activists for years, but at the same time, there are people who have never been associated with any organization, who come from more marginalized neighborhoods and face serious struggles in everyday life. And they've decided to come today to fight for the right to housing. For example, that girl over there in the purple shirt. She's pregnant, and in fact, yesterday she passed her due date. And she's over there with her boyfriend because she's been affected by the housing crisis, and she can't think of a better place to be right now. She's 20 years old, from the Macarena, and is one of these people who had never been to a protest before. but through the movement for the right to housing, here she is. And there are a lot of folks just like her.
Nunca ha ido a una manifestación y nunca ha ido a ningún sitio, pero a raíz del movimiento por el derecho a la vivienda, pues aquí está. Y como ella, pues hay muchísimos vecinos.
Reporting from the front lines of the struggle against austerity in the poorest region of Spain, this is DJ Plebe for Radio Autonomía.
Part 2. Beyond Representative Democracy. While the state tried to seduce us this year with spectacle-filled electoral campaigns in several countries throughout the globe, including Mexico, France, the U.S., and Egypt, many local communities generated new social relations and ways of being with each other. In thinking about going beyond representative democracy, John Holloway asks, what does anti-state mean in the details of everyday practice? Is it worthwhile to consider that what it means to practice autonomy in everyday life is not waiting for politicians to change social conditions, but rather it means to enact self-determination in our daily routines and practices? In the following, we look at two stories that show communities going beyond representative democracy and exploring the meaning of self-determination. The first is an excerpt from a special report on the Biblioteca Popular Victor Martínez in East Oakland, which we produced in August 2012. The second excerpt is from the 35th anniversary of the Social and Public Art Resources Center, SPARC, in Venice, California.
For Radio Autonomía, this is a special report from the Biblioteca Popular Victor Martínez in Oakland. Today, August 13, 2012, the Victor Martínez People's Library was opened at 1449 Miller Avenue in the Fruitvale District of Oakland. Decades after it was left abandoned, this historic building, which was once the home of the Emiliano Zapata Street Academy, was liberated this morning by community members who are transforming the space into an autonomous community center and library. Donated books have begun to fill the shelves while neighborhood kids are building a community garden outside.
Got here at 7 o'clock in the morning to find the building open. We had amassed a collection of books with a project like this in mind, so we brought those down. And that was really just kind of the seed of the library, and by now it's probably tripled in size from the donations that people have brought from the neighborhood. We decided to call it the Biblioteca Popular Victor Martínez after the San Francisco poet who died last year. He died of lung cancer, probably caused from picking crops as a boy. Mm-hmm. He's just a wonderful poet who wrote a book, Parrot in the Oven, that's influenced a lot of people and is kind of a keystone work of the Latino experience. So we thought he was a good choice.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
This has been a school, oddly enough, and it was an alternative school. I think there's a person, the guy with the hat, can tell you a little bit more. I think his mm-hmm. siblings went to the school. It was started by a group of radical Chicano activists. So it was an alternative school for a little while in the 80s and in the 90s. And then it was a continuation school. It was a library from 1918 to 1973. This was one of four libraries donated by the Carnegie Foundation. And it's been pretty much empty. There was a halfway house here for a little while, but for at least 10 years, it's been pretty much empty. And this, if you've ever passed through this neighborhood, this thing is just like it's just like sucks the energy out of this neighborhood. It's dark at night. People throw their garbage here. People don't kind of feel safe or like hanging out in this space. It creates a big dead zone here. But when you look at what's happening right now, there's like, you know, just adding the books and adding a place where people can come together and create, you know, a vibrant community space, it completely changes the dynamic of the community. People are talking to each other in these homes and in these apartment buildings who never knew each other before. And they're coming and they're doing it here. They're sitting down and reading a book. And I think liberating these spaces and giving and kind of offering them to the community, which may not have the courage or know how to do it themselves, and then letting them take over at a certain point, which is, I think, what a lot of us would like to see happen here.
Tell us about what happened today. What happened this morning?
Well, this morning a call went out on Facebook that said this building was open and ready for people to occupy and put a library here. And there are people, you'll be able to talk to some of them involved who've been involved in sort of ad hoc libraries. They bring a bunch of books to a public space, and then it's a honor system where you take out a book and bring it back when you're ready to take another, and so we can kind of trust each other. And they have a lot of books, and there was a call out for books, so they brought the books here. No one knew what they would find. And when we got in the building, we found out that the shelves from the original library are still up all over the walls. And so we started filling them up. We started asking for more books. People from the community came and started bringing us books. A couple from around the corner brought us like a whole dolly stack full of books. Kids, some of these kids brought books that they weren't using anymore, and they've taken books. They've started working on a community garden in the back. It's just been, and I've never seen in all the occupations I've been involved in, I've never seen kids come here by themselves and start taking on tasks. They're not coming over here and screwing around or like taking up space or knocking shit around. They are actually involved. They are bottom lining things. They are bottom lining the garden. They are bottom lining cleaning. They are bottom lining bringing kids' books out into the bookshelves. It's just been a really amazing thing to watch. And the community just is so behind this. I haven't heard one negative remark about what we're doing.
Murals and public art were popularized in the U.S. through the WPA funding during the 1930s in the work of the Tres Grandes, or the Three Giants, José Orozco, David Siqueiros, and Diego Rivera. Since then, various social movements and diverse communities have found murals and public art as an effective means to communicate ideas, document histories and struggles, and preserve cultural practices and traditions. 35 years ago, in Venice, California, three women came together and explored the role of art in preserving history and communal memory. In the development of the Social and Public Art Resource Center, otherwise known as SPARC, these women began to see art as an integral part of the civil rights and social justice movements of that time.
Our first audio segment is from Donna Ditch, one of the three founders of SPARC. She explains how SPARC began with a break-in into the old Venice police station 35 years ago.
How it all sort of started, in a way, is that during that era, 35 years ago, when we all believed that we could do anything, and so Judy was my partner at the time, and you know how it is, we can talk each other into just about anything. That was all part of the time and part of how we were. And so this jail was boarded up. It was, the police had gone. They had gone to a new jail. And so one day, Judy and I decided we got to break into this place. So we came over here and we broke into the place and got the bright idea that we could turn this into SPARC, Social Public Art Resource Center, turn it into a community art center. And that is how the whole thing began.
Maria Elena Durazo, a longtime labor rights organizer, explains not only how Judith Baca produced murals about labor struggles in L.A., but through the process of production, gave voice to the voiceless and the marginalized.
And they create, it's ordinary men and women, ordinary people doing extraordinary things with extraordinary power. And the first mural that Judy and Baca and SPARC did that we were involved with, she had the housekeepers and the cooks and the dishwashers come in, and she did what is now known as focus groups. But she did it with them, to talk to them, to listen to them, to feel from them. And what she produced, what they all came up with together, she didn't say, I will do this. I know what's best for them. I know how to project their struggle. She didn't come up with that. She didn't have the arrogance of doing that. She said, I want to hear it from them, and together we will come up with it. And so the mural were these buildings, these hotels and office buildings downtown representing the tourism industry, and just as tall or taller was a cook, was a housekeeper, and a bellman. And she put them where they were due, where they were worthy of being, which is taller and more important than those buildings, than those hotels, and those restaurants.
Culture that endures beyond the scope of our human lives, and that endures beyond the life of mural, a particular mural. It endures because we come together and remember and create memory.
For more information and to stay updated with the current events and programs at Spark, please check out their website, www.sparkmurals.org.
Part 3, Building Alternative Relations of Solidarity. What does it mean to stand in solidarity with others? Or what does it mean to go beyond solidarity? For this segment, we bring up two insightful discussions that take seriously the idea of building alternative relations of solidarity. The first is an excerpt from our interview with Guillermo Rovira and Mariana Mora from Mexico, which aired in June 2012. The second is an excerpt from a report about Emery Douglas's Zapantera project in Chiapas, which aired in December 2012. Both highlight alternative relations that are centered on a politics of encounter and celebrate our culture of resistance.
Just a few weeks ago, in the mountains of Chiapas, Mexico, an encounter took place, an encuentro called Zapantera Negra, Black Panthers meets the Zapatista Rebels. Here's some text from the overview of the project. At the peak of its popularity in 1970, 139,000 copies of the Black Panther newsletter were distributed throughout the United States on a weekly basis. Within its pages, Emery Douglas, the movement's Minister of Culture, published his artworks in an effort to, quote, illustrate conditions that made revolution seem necessary and construct a visual mythology of power for people who felt powerless and victimized. The newsletter and its accompanying illustrations played a central role in the articulation of the What We Want, What We Believe portion of the Black Panther's 10-point program. In 1994, the Zapatista Uprising, a Mexican indigenous movement originating in the southern state of Chiapas, generated and disseminated a different sort of mass communication made possible by the rise of the internet. The Black Panther and the Zapatista movements occurred in distinct cultural, political, and historical milieus. Nonetheless, the two share a common appreciation of the power of the image and the written word to build their respective social movements into personal, collective, transformative, and public experiences. Zapantera Negra, ZPN, will be a single-run magazine of 20,000 full-color copies that will merge the powerful imagery and layout style of Emery Douglas with the visions and voices of Zapatista painters and embroidery collectives. It will bring the two similar movements together on the page to demonstrate their commonalities, tie the movements to the present, and articulate a new, collaborative, interdisciplinary mode of information distribution and political, social, and economic self-identification.
Okay, so first, Emery, why are you here in Chiapas, in the Caracol Morelia?
Well, I was invited to do an artist in residency and to also come and to do some graphic work with the at the Zapatista communities here in Chiapas.
Okay, so what's your relationship with the Zapatista movement?
Well, I guess it's because in solidarity in relationship to their struggle for the basic human rights is the tangible connection that we have together. In the spirit of what they represent symbolically is the connection between the Black Panther Party of that era and the Zapatistas.
Last week in San Francisco, we had a chance to interview two activists from Mexico City about the question of solidarity and its relation to Zapatismo. Guillermo Rovira is author of several books, including Mujeres de Maíz and Zapatistas sin Fronteras. Mariana Mora is one of the editors of the new book, Luchas Muy Otras, Zapatismo y Autonomía en las Comunidades Indígenas de Chiapas.
My name is Guillermo Rovira. I am a professor in the Universidad Autónoma Metropolitana at the Xochimilco campus. So my relation to Zapatismo is, well, I have done journalism for many years in Chiapas, but I don't consider myself to be simply a journalist or academic. I'm also an activist. I come from the Catalonian libertarian anarchist tradition, and I found a profound resonance with my political imaginary in Chiapas. Over many years, I've been going there. I think that's probably enough of an introduction. Now I live in Mexico City.
My name is Mariana Mora. I'm a researcher and professor at CSS in Mexico City, which is the Center for Research and Advanced Studies in Social Anthropology. Like Guiomar, I've spent many years living in Chiapas collaborating, primarily in popular education workshops in autonomous municipalities, and then later doing work for my PhD fieldwork.
For me, the key to solidarity is not to think of it as a relationship of someone giving something to another who doesn't have anything. Solidarity forms the basis for a political articulation between us, understanding that the other is you. That is the foundation of solidarity and the possibility of action, concentrating on the possibility of defending ourselves together. So, solidarity for me is the capacity to articulate solutions, answers collectively, in order to defend ourselves against attacks from the system, attacks from the state, and the creative capacity to organize ourselves and exchange and create something that doesn't yet exist.
I think one can construct solidarity in a liberal sense, as you were mentioning, Guiomar, which is really guilt cleansing and to always look outside. What helps me understand my definition is what are those reference points that are opposite of what I think? So one of those reference points is when you see the other as someone totally different from you. I see this in the liberal sense of what solidarity means, which is to help those poor people, those who need help, and now I feel better about myself because I've helped them out. My definition of liberal solidarity is pretty simplified, but there it is. And the other way to see solidarity is when one looks for a common platform. Therefore, one is a view of extreme difference, and the other is a view that erases differences between everybody and says, we are all oppressed, we're all the same. For me, those two poles mark a situation where power inequalities are generated and reproduced, and that breaks really with what I think solidarity is. So for me, solidarity really happens in these spaces of identification with the other, which can be ephemeral, and this identification doesn't have to be because there are points in common or because we know each other, therefore we're the same. Rather, it's because there's identification in an affective space. It can be something that Raquel Gutierrez once said at the Casa de Ondas in Mexico City. You know, she said that she wants to break with this ideological solidarity of politics and of logic and instead work from the solidarity that comes from the gut.
Part 4. Reimagining Oakland. For our final segment, we reflect on local manifestations of autonomy and dignity. We look at inspiring gestures of reimagining another Oakland, where children and teachers design their own learning strategies through direct actions, where Occupy Oakland gave us new understandings of insurrectional politics, and where we found new social relationships born out of struggle and a shared sense of hope. The first excerpt is from our interview with organizers from The Holdout, a new autonomous social center in Oakland, which aired in September 2012. The second excerpt is from our interview with a participant in the Lakeview Elementary sit-in in July 2012. Finally, we've concluded with an excerpt from our interview with a member of the Justice for Alan Bluford Coalition, which we aired in December 2012.
The Holdout has been a space that we all have been visiting since it's open and is playing a really critical role right now, especially after our Occupy spaces have kind of been fragmented and dispersed. The Holdout is one of those places that has been consistent in its politics and in its location. So, Patti and Autumn, thank you for coming in. If you guys could start out giving people a background on the whole, folks that haven't heard about what the Holdout is, and also folks all over the world who are interested in seeing what we're doing here in the Bay Area. So, a little bit what the Holdout is, the politics of the space. Is it a space of encounter, space of learning?
This is Bhatti speaking, and Autumn will be speaking in a minute. So first off, to talk about a little bit of the background of the holdout, it's about a year and a half of intentional organization that went into the planning of the holdout. We are now currently perhaps about 8 months into being open. Prior to being open, we have been gathering with friends and comrades who have a long, long, long time of organizing anti-authoritarian, anti-hierarchical projects in the Bay Area for several years. So we come with that type of a background already. We are very interested in the holdout being in a non-hierarchical, anti-authoritarian space, and have put a lot of effort into this. We've had like super long, plus hour, 3 hour meetings. We're very interested in being able to promote anti-gentrification in the community that we're in. We're located on in West Oakland, San Pablo near 23rd. And we're really excited about having all kinds of DIY type of projects, including a bike workshop where it's multi-generational, multi-skilled, multi-gendered, and we have other spaces like the bookstore. We have a radical bookstore with an excellent selection of books focusing on anarchism and gender and radical black politics and POC, things that would be interesting to like POC struggle and the sort, and feminism. Yeah, and we also have also projects concerning Skillshares, and some of the Skillshares that we're really excited about that we're both working on are classes in Spanish, soon to be classes for ESL, and classes for Spanish for folks who would consider themselves raza or Chicanos, Chicanas. So that's a little bit of the background to the space. We're really excited about having it be a space of encounter, a space where people can develop further camaraderie and work on projects together outside of the holdout. Also have it be a space where people are building sustainability, building in order to resist capitalism, in order to fight back the police repression and federal oppression of the state within Oakland and outside of Oakland. We're really excited about like the grassroots involvement from folks within that area. And we've, ever since, even before obtaining the space, we would do like door knocking and lots of outreach to get ideas from the community to see what their needs are and what they would be interested in seeing in the space. So, for example, we have a needle exchange project taking place, and we also have a very open field next to ours that we're in the process of trying to obtain so that we can at some point start growing food and become more sustainable and maybe even have like a youth area, an area for kids as well.
On June 15th, Friday, at the close of the school day, parents, teachers, and students at Lakeview Elementary School refused to leave the campus and initiated a sit-in occupation of their school to protest the closures of five elementary schools in Oakland that were slated for closure by OUSD, the Oakland Unified School District, in the face of fiscal crisis and the state's pushing for austerity measures. And so parents, teachers, and students, along with other educational justice activists, initiated this sit-in, and it's in its 16th day today, and we have a good friend and compatriot who's here to talk about how this action has evolved and what's at stake.
Thank you. Well, first I should say that this action is a long time coming, that the austerity measures that you mentioned before are a product of more than 30 years of cutbacks by the state of California, but also measures at the national level. If you're a public educator nowadays, there's no doubt that public education is under attack, and that this is a direct and deliberate effort to move toward privatization. One thing that many people don't know is that a school district is required by law to have a budget that is in the black for 3 years, projected out from the numbers that are given to them at any one time. And so this action is the result of several years of parents and teachers mobilizing. The Occupy Education group formed about a year ago, And they've been trying many means of addressing the concerns around the closures of these elementary schools. They've gone to school board meetings, they've protested, they've flyered, they've written letters, they've worked on fundraising measures, they've tried everything they can think of. And it was only about a month ago that they realized that this was going to happen, that the school board was going to go through with this. And they decided that it was time to escalate. And that's very exciting to me as a public educator. I'm a K-12 teacher, and I've been a teacher for 15 years. And I have to say, it's been over a decade that I've been waiting for parents and other teachers to move beyond flyering, beyond the rally model, to push for greater audiences.
Could you talk about the people's school that's being run during the week?
Gladly. So on the last day of school, the parents, teachers, staff, and students who worked on this action had a barbecue. It was very fun, and a lot of people joined in to celebrate the beginning of the sit-in. And after the barbecue, the parents and teachers and children, they didn't leave. They set up tents in front of the school, and over the weekend, there were rallies and there were teach-ins. But the people's school really started on Monday, the 18th of June, and the intent is to reconceive public education, that we can make the education we want for our students and for our children. And so parents and certified teachers, so there are certificated teachers on the grounds at all times, run classes for students during a regular school day throughout the school week. So really it's a free summer school in a way. But not in your typical sit at a desk and be forced to learn kind of situation. There's gardening, there are games, and there's a focus on social justice as a theme within the curriculum.
We're going to start out with our comrade Molly here, who is going to talk to us about the Justice for Alan Bluford Coalition and the recent work that's been happening around the struggle for justice for this young man who we will learn more about right now. So maybe you could start off by telling us, who is Alan Bluford?
Thank you very much, Magali. Alan Bluford is an 18-year-old boy who was on May 6th of this year murdered by OPD for really not, as far as I can see, nothing much more than the color of his skin and being out after midnight in East Oakland. And what happened was two OPD officers, Officer Miguel Masso and his partner, rolled up on Alan Bluford and his three friends on the street in East Oakland basically pulled him over, racial profiling incident, kind of a, you know, stop and frisk, which is not a law here in Oakland, but basically a de facto law, and pulled Alan and his, you know, stopped Alan and his friends for that. And for reasons we really don't know, Alan ran and Miguel Masso chased him for approximately four blocks, and Alan tripped over a street corner at that point, fell on his back, and Officer Miguel Masso fired three shots into Alan while he was laying on his back. And from what the forensic report shows, it does look like his arms, you know, when he fell on his back, that his arms went up over his head. The coalition came about, it's really, I would say, it was a lot of members from left over from the Oscar Grant movement, and then there's a lot of people from Occupy, as well as people from Answer Coalition, as well as just concerned community members. We have students with, like, the Black Student Union, who are starting to join us, both at Laney and at Merritt. And we have civil rights lawyers, four, who are working with us. So we all came together, you know, within days, some of us, after Alan's murder, and, you know, began organizing.
This has been a special review of 2012 by Radio Autonomía. For the full-length versions of all of the segments excerpted here, as well as more information about the movements, please visit our website, radioautonomía.wordpress.com. Tengo
la paz se resuelta, el plan de la revuelta, la clave, la propuesta, el sol en esta puesta. Soy disciplina en esta táctica y el sabio es el más fuerte. Soy el que lleva por la espalda un mar de gente. Soy la campiña incendiaria, la mente que jamás es ordinaria, la guía de la cuadrilla por el cambio verdadero. El agente encubierto en el sistema del mortero, la risa del mendigo por la solución posible, la ira del burócrata que finge no es visible, la medicina para Mike en su virtual melancolía. Y voy educando a Víctor Vargas sin saber pedagogía, y es larga vida para mí, para mis próceres. Es el día uno en la misión más específica, es mi posgrado en la visión por siempre crítica. Es el día uno.